You're listening to Inland Edition. I'm Lillian Vasquez. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and in 2020, as we deal with the coronavirus pandemic, taking stock of our mental health is more important than ever. So today, we've invited Dr. Gayani Da Silva to be our guest. She's the Behavioral Health Medical Director for IEHP.
Oh, thank you so much, Lillian. I'm glad to be with you.
You know, mental health is an ongoing issue in everyday life. Now with COVID-19 in our world, what are we seeing manifest during this pandemic with regards to mental health?
Well, you know, mental health historically has been kind of stigmatized and marginalized, but now more and more people are contending with mental health issues because we are all stuck in this crisis of COVID-19. So I'm seeing a lot of people who have never before really considered their mental health or thought about depression or anxiety, and now they're feeling lonely and controlled and helpless and hopeless, and they're beginning to feel sad that's persistent. You know, clinical depression is a constellation of physical and emotional symptoms that persist for a week or so. Sadness, insomnia, loss of appetite, lethargy, loss of interest in things that were pleasurable before, lack of motivation, poor concentration, feelings of guilt. All of these symptoms are part of depression, and now more and more people are feeling them. And they're also feeling anxious because there's so much that we don't know about COVID-19 and about the virus itself and the course of illness and who is most at risk. You know, we thought it was just the elderly with underlying illnesses, but now we're learning that even children are getting very, very sick and even dying from COVID-19. So there's so much unknown that creates a lot of anxiety too in many people.
When we talk about mental health, what issues actually fall into this bucket? What other categories fall into mental health?
Mental health is so broad, you know, and there's a continuum of symptoms. So it can be very mild symptoms like occasional sadness or occasional anxiety. And then it can get even worse to mood disorders like bipolar disorder. And it can get to clinical depression and generalized anxiety disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, social phobia, obsessive-compulsive disorder. All of these are part of the constellation of anxiety symptoms. And then you could also have schizophrenia, which a lot of people associate with people who are homeless, you know, who hear voices and see things, have hallucinations, and have paranoia. But schizophrenia can really afflict anybody. And so there may be a lot of people who aren't homeless who also have schizophrenia. So mental health illness encompasses all of these mild symptoms to very severe symptoms, and that can affect people's lives in very devastating ways. But with treatment, mental illness, mental health can be quite well managed.
All right. I want to ask a little deeper. I didn't hear you mention suicidal thoughts or suicide, and mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that is in this environment as well.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because suicidal thoughts, homicidal thoughts, those kinds of very deep, painful states of mind are part of mental illness and a part of mental health. And with a crisis situation like COVID-19, those thoughts, those intentions, and getting stuck in that kind of thinking is going to be more prevalent. People are at higher risk of it. People are more vulnerable to feeling suicidal and homicidal.
All right. So let's talk about specifically, I think you mentioned some of them, specifically the symptoms that we're seeing, isolation and mm-hmm. not really knowing what COVID-19 is and mm-hmm. and some of those things. Can you talk a little bit about those? And then if we can talk about how we're addressing them or how they can be addressed.
Sure. So this kind of prolonged state of being socially isolated can be quite traumatic for many people. Actually, it can be traumatic for everybody, because this is not a usual state of being for humans.
Right.
Humans are typically quite social. We need social interaction. We crave it. We seek it. Even introverts need that social interaction. And actually, you know, I know that you do some work with kids who are on the spectrum of autism and other developmental disabilities. And sometimes we think of those kids as being in their own world, but actually they also need social interaction, and they need to be accepted. So in this climate of social isolation, it becomes very complicated for people, and they get prone to and vulnerable to getting quite depressed and anxious. And we have already seen people who are on the front lines and not on the front lines committing suicide. You know, they're in the media quite a lot, and it's devastating. The people, the healthcare workers who are on the front lines are working. They're basically burning the candle at both ends, right? They're trying to protect their families, and they're taking care of their families, plus they're taking care of other families, and they're seeing devastating results and devastating scenarios and really sad scenarios as they're taking care of people who are isolated. Because even the folks in the hospital, maybe not even for COVID-19, but for other reasons, are being isolated from their loved ones and family, and the healthcare workers have to step in and give that nurturance and support to these patients on top of the medical care that they're giving. And so, unfortunately, we have seen some suicides from that as well. So when people are not taking care of their own mental health, their own needs, their emotional needs, their nurturance needs, their needs for kindness from other people and from themselves, and time to rest and sleep and eat properly and exercise, when you're not getting that, then you become quite vulnerable to having a mood disorder like depression or anxiety really settle in and dig in deep. And it's not anyone's fault. You know, it's having suicidal thoughts or homicidal thoughts really is not anything anybody wishes to have. They are a product of your mind and the chemistry and the neurology of your mind getting to a place where they can't get out of without intervention.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Dr. De Silva. She is the medical director of behavior health for IEHP. So now that you've said some of those things, and if meds or getting into a physician right at this point is not an option, or maybe it is, I don't know. But what are some of the things we can do, or what are some of the ways to combat this? What are you suggesting?
So luckily, people can see their psychiatrist or their mental health provider and their therapist, and new patients can be established with psychiatry and with therapy.
Okay.
And this may not be done in person, mm-hmm. But many clinics have switched over to telepsychiatry. I want to encourage everybody, if they need assistance, to get assistance earlier rather than later and make those phone calls and get an appointment. You can be evaluated over the phone or via a video. New technology for a lot of people, those of us in the business of taking care of patients, we like to see people in person, but we all have to make do, and providers are adapting to this situation. So there is help out there. People can prescribe medication. They can talk to you. They can get you in to see therapy. You can have an hour, you know, 45 minutes to an hour session with a therapist. It is covered by insurance. It's been mandated at the state level, at least, and federal, that this kind of telephonic assessment and medication prescribing is allowed and it's appropriate. So there's definitely help out there.
Is that just with IEHP, or any insurances are doing this telephonic therapy?
Any insurance is doing it right now. You might want to check just on the particulars of how to bill and,
sure,
you know, just the logistics of it, but it's definitely out there. And people want to talk about providers. They really want to meet the needs of their community. I have many friends and colleagues who are trying to take care of patients and people in the community, and they definitely want you to reach out.
Now, you are talking about a medical way to help some of these individuals, but is there things at home that we can do? Is just going outside and sitting in our backyard and getting sunshine, or, you know, it's, I'm not a professional, but can you share things that we can try?
Absolutely. So the first thing to do is to be aware that your mental health is important and that your mental health is tied into your general wellness. And so whatever makes you feel well, do. And whereas before a crisis situation, we may have taken care of ourselves every other day or every third day or once a week, we really need to do it every day now. Go outside, get some sun, put your feet in the grass, take a little walk around your neighborhood, get, you know, 20 minutes of exercise, helps get the blood flowing, helps your whole body, you know, be healthy and your mind clear. Take time out of the day to just rest and tend to your own needs. Do the usual stuff. Have a nice little routine for yourself. Get up, brush your teeth, wash your face, take a shower, get dressed, have breakfast. Nutrition is very important. All the basics are super important because that's going to lay the foundation for resiliency and for your overall wellness. sleep at a regular time. Don't get too stressed out about sleep. Sleep is a little funny. If we put too much pressure on ourselves to sleep, we tend to have difficulty. Don't say anything negative about your sleep. Just be positive. Anticipate a good night's sleep. Know that it's important for you. That helps maintain your stress levels and your stress hormones, because cortisol decreases at nighttime and peaks during the day. Cortisol is a stress hormone, and it also affects our immune system. So if we stay up too late, then cortisol doesn't come down. It stays up and continues to suppress your immune system. And this is a time when we really need our immune system to be at its top shape.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
I would imagine, and we have heard, that alcohol consumption has increased. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure some of the companies that sell alcohol are happy with this to a degree. But can you speak on that topic of the alcohol consumption?
Yeah, it's a great topic to speak of, because we use alcohol sometimes to cope with stressful situations, to take the edge off. And, you know, a little bit of using alcohol in that way is okay. But the danger really arises when we're using alcohol on a daily basis or drinking a lot more than we should in order to cope. And if that's the only coping mechanism that you're using, the risk of getting into that habit increases drastically. So make sure you're using other means of coping with this extremely stressful situation, like reaching out to your friends, having those phone calls, doing Zoom get-togethers, taking a walk, petting your dog or your cat. That actually reduces your stress hormones as well. Just petting your animal for a minute or two every day, taking care of yourself. Those kind of coping mechanisms are a lot better than drinking. Now, the risk of addiction is really greatest in the ages between like 13 and 25. When your brain is finishing its development of certain aspects of the brain, like the reward system and the limbic system. And the limbic system is the area of the brain that helps you manage your emotions, anger, sadness, loneliness, happiness, all of that. Your memory and your higher cortical functioning in your brain. So that's where you're most vulnerable to starting an addiction. So if you're older than 25 and you're drinking more, it's more dangerous that you might develop a habit of coping with alcohol. And then, of course, alcohol does damage your body, your liver. It's very toxic to your liver. It is a depressant as well, so it can increase your risk of developing depression.
Got it. Okay. Let's take a quick break here. I'm Lillian Vasquez, and this is Inland Edition from Empire KVCR News. Today, we're talking about mental health with IEHP Behavioral Health Medical Director, Dr. Guyani Da Silva. After the break, we'll look at impacts COVID-19 might be having on different generations of people and those with special needs. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. You're listening to KVCR. I'm Lillian Vasquez, and this is Inland Edition. Let's get back to my interview with Dr. Da Silva, Behavioral Health Medical Director for IEHP, the Inland Empire Health Plan. Dr. Da Silva, can we talk about the mental health impacts that the coronavirus pandemic is having on people right now? In what age groups are we seeing the pandemic taking the biggest toll, or is it spread out evenly for all ages?
It's different in all ages. I don't know if we actually have the numbers yet for the different age groups, but in children, the change is, and we're talking neurotypic children right now. The neurotypic children, they have a loss of their schedule and their social network. The academics, actually, people are talking a lot about kids losing traction in their academics, but that's not really the main issue. They'll catch up on their academics.
Right.
But the issue really is their social and brain development, problem-solving development, their mental health development of being able to manage relationships, difficulties in dynamics, and manage their emotions. So parents really need to kind of pay attention to that part. The academics will come, you know, in a few months. That's not a big deal. But the emotional development is huge. And kids, you know, they may not say, hey, mom, I'm depressed. I'm lonely.
Of course.
They
right.
may not say that, right? So parents have to be a little vigilant about interacting with them and making sure that they're having some contact with their friends and maybe going out their way a little bit to be very creative about how they do that.
Now, that's the younger. What about your tweens or your teens?
tweens and teens even more so because, you know, parents are quite influential to children until about the age of 11. And then from 11 on, their friends and social networks become much more influential. Not that parents aren't important. They are important.
Of course.
But, you know, the outside world becomes so much more important for children. So these tweens and teens, it's really going to be important for parents to help them develop those social networks and stay in contact with their friends, maybe encourage them to do a Zoom meeting or encourage them to participate in their Zoom classrooms, encourage them to talk to their friends and maintaining social distancing appropriately and being safe, but having that conversation.
And what about our seniors? Our seniors, the 55 plus?
Oh, yeah. You know, when this whole thing started, I was so worried about our seniors because seniors already are at one of the highest risk groups for suicide and suicidal ideation, loneliness and depression. You know, depression, anxiety, that level of mental illness affects physical well-being as well. The seniors are quite vulnerable, and to be so isolated right now is a huge concern. So I'm really glad that people are reaching out to their loved ones who are in nursing homes and who are a little more isolated, having FaceTime conversations with their parents every day kind of thing. I strongly encourage that and think that that is going to help. And just asking our elderly family members, you know, how are you feeling every day and what do you need and how can I be more helpful to you and more involved with you? Maybe interacting with them a couple times a day instead of just once a day, certainly more than once a week. I think that's just not enough. We've got to just drastically increase our level of reaching out to our elderly populations.
Right. So really making the time to connect with our aunts and uncles and parents and whoever mm-hmm. we have in our world.
Yeah.
Now, you did touch on, and you know, I'm going to ask this, but what about our special needs, our Down syndrome, and of course, those with autism? Are they feeling it as well? Sometimes people think that, you know, they don't process any of that or they don't feel any of that. Where are you on that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, historically, we have thought in the past that kids don't have an emotional world and they just kind of go along with whatever we create for them.
Right.
But that's not true at all. And certainly even kids who have developmental disabilities, Downs or autism, sometimes it's hard to understand what's going on with them, that we sort of brush them under the rug and say, oh, they're going to be fine. But that's not true at all. They have a very rich and deep and extensive emotional world and experience. Just because we don't understand it doesn't mean it's not there. I am getting a lot of phone calls and text messages and emails from former patients, parents of mine who are saying, oh my gosh, my child is really struggling right now. I don't know what to do. They are having more outbursts. They were potty trained and now they're having lots of accidents in their pants and I don't know what to do. Is this a problem? And the thing is that everyone regresses during a crisis, adults regress and children, and kids who have some developmental difficulties will also regress a bit. So we have to expect that they're going to have more outbursts. They're going to have more potty accidents. Any kind of developmental process that they struggle with, they're going to struggle even more with that. They've lost their schedule. And for kids who are on the spectrum, that's very difficult to deal with, any kind of change to their schedule. So what I am offering to my parents and suggesting is that they get a whiteboard or a big piece of white paper and draw out or write out very clearly what the schedule is going to be for the day, and then touch base to that schedule several times through the day so that the child is aware that there is a structure to their day. And it's a new structure, but they will get used to the structure that you create for them. And using a lot more sensory tools like a weighted blanket or fidget tools for their fingers, those are very helpful also for these kids. Stick to that structure. Be very, very patient with them. For older kids, maybe around 5, 6, 7, you can use, there's a book called Coping Cat that UCI actually uses with their children. So that can help them with their feelings. Ask your kids every day how they're feeling, what they need, what's going on for them. Be interested and patient. Sit next to them while you ask. Don't sit right in front of them because that tends to be kind of confrontational. But if you sit next to them, it gives them that very tangible feeling of, oh, mom or dad, my caregiver is on my side, right next to me. And you can also give some touch to them when they're right next to you. You can put your arm around them or you can give them a side hug and be kind of quiet with them and give them a lot of space. They will need breaks.
What about our young adults with special needs? And maybe with autism, you often find they don't have any language, so you can't really ask them how they're feeling. But how are you, what's your coping methods for young adults or maybe adults with autism or Downs that are, and Downs are tend to be very sociable.
So the caregivers who are with these folks need to be very patient with them and explain and go along with their schedule. But same thing, you know, really to maintain a schedule with them, maybe be a little more indulgent in the things that they need and be creative in some of the ideas that they might get fixated on, allow for more of that. So I really think like a little pullback in being rigid about learning or behaving in certain ways or behaving in what might be quote unquote appropriate ways. Just kind of pull back on that a bit. Let the person guide the caregiver with what they might need in that moment.
And lastly, what is your greatest takeaway? What do you want listeners to know regarding mental health or as we live in this COVID-19 world right now?
I would like people to realize that mental health is something that every single person has a vulnerability towards, and that we need to pay attention to our mental health every day. Our health is not present without focusing on mental health as well. So that's the big takeaway, that we all are the same. We're all in this together for sure, and we are all in it together with mental health too. We can no longer stigmatize and marginalize people who have mental health issues or mental illness, because really we all contend with this every day.
Dr. De Silva, thank you very much for your time. It's been interesting listening to your input and all that you have to say. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you, Lillian, so much for having me.
Dr. Guyani De Silva is the Behavioral Health Medical Director for IEHP. For more on IEHP, you can visit their website at iehp.org. That's Inland Edition for this Tuesday. Please join me again tomorrow. I'll be speaking with Dr. Joe Chaffin, Chief Medical Officer for our local blood bank, Lifestream. That's Wednesday at 2 p.m. and 5:30 on Inland Edition. To hear this and future shows, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/Inland Edition. You can also listen to Inland Edition on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Play Music. Search for Inland Edition on your streaming service. I'm Lillian Vasquez. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.